The Guardian.
Lovely to be back in Swindon. The last time I came to Swindon, I walked out of the railway station and someone shouted at me, "Get out of Swindon, you knobhead." I'm irrepressible. I wanted to come straight back.
Yes, that was David Cameron demonstrating his knack for speaking the language of the street. I'm Nick Watt, and in this week's edition of Politics Weekly, we are going to take a look at the Conservative leader after his strongest year since getting the job in 2005. We'll be asking whether his 20-point lead in the polls means the Cameron family should now be measuring the curtains in Downing Street. We'll also be asking whether Lara Croft, yes, Cameron told The Guardian this week that he is the hero of the Tomb Raider series, really is a moderniser, or whether he would impose old-fashioned Tory policies on us. And we'll be hearing from Richard Thaler, the American economist who inspired the latest idea driving the Tories, the nudge theory. Joining me to discuss these matters from the Guardian Room in the House of Commons is Michael Gove, the Shadow School Secretary, who is one of the brains behind the Cameron operation. Have you chosen your ministerial car yet, Michael?
No, I haven't, Nick. I suspect there's probably going to be about 2 years before the election. And one of the things that the last 12 months have shown us is that politics is exceptionally volatile. So we don't know what's going to happen then. We're only going to be in a position to be confident about having the chance to serve if we make the difficult decisions between then and now in the right way. So I'm just going to stick to my non-ministerial bike for the moment.
We have Jenny Russell, the Guardian columnist. Jenny, modesty from Michael Gove there, but the Tories and Cameron are on a pretty decisive roll.
Yeah, and they're just being careful not to sound too confident because they know how that might damage them with the electorate. But I think those of us who are observing think it's pretty unlikely that they're not going to win.
And finally, we have Julian Glover, The Guardian's chief leader writer, who is also our polling guru. So a 20-point lead, not bad.
It's amazing, really. A year ago, we were saying the Tories have been flatlining. They've gone up a bit. Brown's taken the lead. Where's it all going? And suddenly the Tories have just established this strong, sustained lead. I suspect it will narrow a bit, maybe over the summer. Labour might look like they're coming back, but in the end, nobody thinks Labour can win a majority.
OK, thanks for that. Now, before I let our panel loose, I'm just going to turn to Michael Gove to tell us about David Cameron, the man. In his Guardian interview this week, David Cameron, as we said, likened himself to Lara Croft as a moderniser. He's decontaminating the Tory brand by clearing each level in the computer game. He also admitted, though, that he was a latecomer to the modernisation project. Tell us about Cameron the Moderniser, Michael.
Well, I think one of the reasons why David would acknowledge he was a latecomer to modernisation is that, funnily enough, David was probably closer to the old-fashioned moderate one-nation tradition within the Tory party. I think a lot of people tended to put David down as a right-winger because he worked for Norman Lamont and for Michael Howard. But he worked for them in the same way as civil servants worked for them. And I think that they automatically assumed that he was on the Thatcherite wing of the party. Not at all. He was very much a moderate, but because he was a moderate, he probably underestimated the extent to which the Conservative Party's image, brand and policies had been corroded by the experience of the 1990s.
But we do occasionally get flashes of somebody who you could describe as quite an old-fashioned Conservative, who until relatively recently supported Section 28. I mean, it's interesting, in the Commons vote on IVF treatment in May, David Cameron sided with Ian Duncan Smith in saying there was a need for a father and a mother before women, i.e. lesbian couples, could be given fertility treatment. That's quite old-fashioned, isn't it?
Well, one of the things that's distinctive about what David's been promoting is the importance of having a coherent policy which supports the family and commitment. And he made the decision to back Ian in the division lobbies on that particular occasion because he felt it was important that we reinforce cultural signals that said fathers were important. It's striking, however, that George Osborne took a different view, and there are shifts of emphasis within the Conservative Party, or I was going to say different emphases within the Conservative Party, on how you approach this particular issue. More broadly, though, I think it's crucial to see that the way in which David has changed the party encompasses a huge range of issues.
OK, thanks for that, Michael. Well, we asked Simon Hoggart, the Guardian's parliamentary sketch writer, to assess David Cameron's performance over the last year in the House of Commons.
Simon Hoggart, parliamentary sketch writer for The Guardian. It's been a very, very good term for David Cameron. If he had a report card, it would be looking pretty much like straight A's. He's looked in the chamber so much more sprightly on his feet than the Prime Minister.
Once again, absolutely
once
no
again,
apology.
He cannot be straight with people.
He lands little darts at him. I'm reminded very much of a bullfight in which the poor stricken bull gets arrow things from the picadors in his back.
I'm beginning to think the only thing in Downing Street with a spine is his book on courage.
And that's partly because Cameron has got a very good aggressive line. For example, take this week. A Labour backbencher, Richard Burden, stood up and asked what was clearly a planted question. It was the first question of the day. The whips wanted him to ask Gordon Brown what wonderful things he was doing to guard us, to shield us from the effects of the world downturn. And Tories wouldn't let him get it out. They just barracked and barracked and barracked. And every time Mr. Burden came back, he sounded more and more feeble and they jeered more and more. Finally, Gordon Brown stood up and gave the pre-prepared answer. And Cameron said,
It's a wonderful thing. You don't have to finish a planted question to get a planted answer.
It's not the greatest line in the world, but it is quick, it is swift, it got a great big laugh. And does that matter? Yes, because it's very good for morale when a party leader looks as if he's in command of the House. Cameron, of course, the real thing that's doing so well for him is the fact that he's so far ahead in the polls. If he wasn't ahead in the polls, he wouldn't be getting anything like the support. And there was a lot of rumbling and grumbling around about October last year when Gordon Brown was doing very well and when they absolutely dreaded an election. Since then, of course, it's all gone horribly wrong for Brown. And my feeling is that we've now reached the same point with the electorate as we had with the Tories in 1992. You could almost tell the electorate has simply decided they were never going to vote for this lot again. I think the electorate has got to the point when they're not going to vote Labour again. And I think that's one reason why there's no serious challenge to Gordon Brown at the moment. It's because everybody knows that David Cameron's going to win the next election, and who wants to go down on that sinking ship?
That was Simon Hoggart awarding straight A's for David Cameron. Jenny Russell, let me ask you, do you think that we're in the same territory that we were in the mid-1990s, when Roy Jenkins famously said that Tony Blair was like a museum curator carrying a priceless Ming vase across a slippery floor?
Good God, that's a very strange metaphor. I'm not sure I'd go along with that one. But I certainly think that when you watch Cameron performing at the moment, it's rather like watching Peter Pan dancing around Captain Hook. And Brown just looks utterly stranded, and it's impossible to understand what he says when he's talking in the Commons any longer. He opens his mouth, words come out, and you all look at each other and say, what did that mean? And he's utterly failing to communicate, not just to the viewers, but to his own party, and even to his own supporters. I was talking to somebody yesterday who was sitting in an office, a Labour minister's office, as PMQs was going on, and he said that the researchers in the office were just hysterical with laughter. As Cameron said to Brown, you accuse me of inconsistency, but I'm utterly consistent. I said you were completely useless a year ago, and I still think so now. I mean, when you've got your own side laughing against you, you've really lost it.
So, Julian Glover, Peter Pan versus Captain Hook, Gordon Brown's lost it. You're our polling guru. Have the British people decided they're not going to vote Labour again?
They haven't quite decided that yet. And I mean, we mustn't just turn into a Cameron Gushathon. There are plenty of flaws we can talk about.
We'll be talking about those in a bit, yep.
But back to the polling. The Tories are doing amazingly well. They're doing far better than they thought they would do at this point in a parliament under a leader they might have elected otherwise. If they'd had David Davis, they wouldn't be at this position. A lot of it is to do with Cameron. But the problem is, this isn't yet the general election. Labour insiders say, well, when the election happens, people will look at the two parties and it will narrow. Maybe it will narrow so much the Tories don't get a majority. And I think that's perhaps the key thing we don't discuss. It's not who will come first, who will get most votes. I think the Tories not to get more votes would be quite strange. Will they get enough to form a good, solid government that can do quite radical things, the kind of things that Michael wants to do in education? That's far from certain, just because there's huge numbers of seats in Britain that have Labour MPs that have to have Tory ones for there to be a Tory government. Massive change, huge wipeout of Labour. Is that going to happen? Well, we don't know yet. We need to know maybe 18 months' time.
So, Michael Gove, words of caution there from Julian Glover, but the coverage that your leader is getting at the moment is pretty gushing. Even The Guardian devoted the front pages of both its main sections to him this week. But let me just ask you, can't we just say that the reason he's doing well is because Gordon Brown is doing badly? He hasn't really done the hard work yet.
Well, there is an element of the seesaw about politics. You're absolutely right. And it's undoubtedly the case that one of the things that's driving Labour's poll figures down is the poor performance that Gordon Brown's exhibited over the last 9 months. And it's also the case, crucially, that economic bad news and fears of worse to come are also depressing support for the government. So it would be foolish for anyone to argue that the Conservative lead in the polls has been generated purely by Conservative innovation and the strength of David Cameron's leadership. However, Julian does make the point that under a potential alternative, different Conservative leader, things wouldn't be as good for the Conservatives. And it's undoubtedly the case that David Cameron took steps right from the beginning of his leadership to change the way in which the Conservative Party operated, not just the way in which it was seen, but also the policy priorities that we have. And I don't think that we would have been in a position to benefit from Labour's difficulties in anything like the way that we have if we had anything other, anyone other than David as our leader. And he used a striking metaphor, I think, in his interview with you, Nick, in The Guardian, when he talked about Tomb Raider and having to clear level one before you could get to level two. And level one was that process of essentially wrenching the Conservative Party out of the rut that it had been in, the intellectual rut that it had been in order to get us to become a modern centre-right party.
So, Jenny Russell, does this feel like it was in the late 1970s when Margaret Thatcher was doing some really, really heavy lifting in terms of changing the Conservative Party and challenging the government, completely shifting the balance of politics?
I think there are key differences in that Thatcher was actually trying to bring about a complete revolution in the way that the country operated. And that was what she wanted to do. She utterly wanted to change the old conservative Labour consensus and to bring about radical alteration. I think what's very interesting about the Cameron approach to politics, as we know, is that an awful lot of it has just taken on board all the new Labour ideas of the past 10 years. Both sides now acknowledge, whether it's Ed Miliband or David Cameron, that the next election is basically going to be fought on the kind of liberal centre ground, liberal socially, that Labour has established. So what Cameron has faced is a task which is as large, but it's been very different. What he's had to do is to try and turn the Tories around from being, as Theresa May famously pointed out, the nasty party, into one which has likable people in it, whom you will listen to. And the interesting thing is that he learnt to do this before the analysis, which has now become almost commonplace over the last year, which says that if you want to be listened to by the electorate, says New American Political Theory, then you have to be liked first. They're not going to start listening to your policies. They don't care what you say unless they think, this is a person that I trust. Now, that is what Cameron worked on. He didn't have to come out with very many new policies to begin with. He just had to make sounds that made it clear that he wasn't part of that old, repressive, rather nasty, cut your throat if you don't get to the top Toryism. And he did that so successfully that people now think he's a nice guy. I'm going to listen to what he says, and I'm going to trust what he says. That's been his fantastic achievement. It's been as big an achievement in a way as Thatcher's before she got power, in that he's moving territory. But it's been in the issue of style rather than substance.
I agree with Jenny. I think the comparison with 79 is wrong. In 79, Britain was broken. Thatcher had to change it, and she did, although a lot of that didn't come in until the early 80s. And actually, the 79 manifesto wasn't as radical as we now like to think it was. But with the Tory party now, they need to persuade people that they aren't extreme, that they aren't going to do anything dangerous, and that they are doing that quite successfully. But at the same time, they also need to show they're different. And there are two ways we could look at politics now. One is to say that Gordon Brown and David Cameron basically believe in exactly the same thing, minor details about the sort of emphasis and publicity and what you talk about more, but really it's the same ideas. They even fight over things like the Freud Review. Or you could say, actually, they're pretty different, and they're trying to look the same. I tend to go with the second version. I think Cameron, in his early years, when we were talking about earlier, he wasn't an extremist. The thing about Cameron wasn't that he was left or right. It's that he didn't buy the kind of loopy extremism of parts of the Tory party. But he had a very traditional sense of values, a traditional view of the state, quite a conservative view of the state. And he has that now, and he wants to put it into government. And that's really different to Gordon Brown. He has a very traditional Labour view of the state. Both of them are presenting themselves as liberals at times, as centrists at times. I think Britain will have quite a big choice at the next election. It'll be fashionable to say there isn't really a choice at all. Labour would like to say that.
OK, well, look, we'll come on to the differences between Gordon Brown and David Cameron in a moment. But, Michael Gove, before we do that, let me just ask you one final question on this. It's all looking pretty easy for you, the Conservatives, at the moment, because you're in opposition. But if you win the election, you'll have to deal with record oil prices, you'll have to deal with the mortgage crisis, and you'll also have to live up to your word and impose green taxes.
Yes. No, I was going to say that I don't underestimate for a moment the scale of the difficulties that the next government will inherit. And the point you make about the taxation challenge is an acute one. George Osborne spelled out that any increase in taxation to deal with pollution will be matched by tax relief directed towards families. But it's undoubtedly the case that whatever the final balance that George comes to on that matter, it's going to be against a very, very grim economic background. And when we're talking about some of the intellectual changes that David's presided over within the Conservative Party, everything, of course, is dwarfed by the broader change that the world is going through at the moment. The governor of the Bank of England's characterised that as the ending of the nice decade. And it does mean that whether we're looking at our ambitions to deal with climate change or our ambitions to deal with social mobility, we're operating in a world where the cash has run out, the government's eaten next year's harvest, and we are in tough times.
Well, the new philosophy for the Tories is summed up by one word, nudge. This is the idea dreamt up by the American economist Richard Thaler, that people need a gentle nudge to encourage good behaviour. John Dennis from Guardian.co.uk caught up with Thaler earlier this week and asked him to explain his theory.
A nudge is a small feature of the environment that attracts our attention and in so doing influences our choices.
George Osborne wrote in The Guardian this week, the Shadow Chancellor, appraising your book and cited a Tory policy of putting on energy bills. The idea is that you find out how energy efficient your neighbours are, and if you're not as energy efficient as them, then you'll be more inclined to do something about it.
That's actually an example that we mention in the book. It's a little tricky because giving people feedback that they use more energy than their neighbors did encourage them to cut back a bit. But giving people feedback that they used less energy than their neighbors, they started using more because they said, well, I'm being a bit of a sucker here. But that so-called rebound effect was completely eliminated simply by putting a little smiley face on their bill. So I think we need to fine tune these, but yes, I think giving people feedback on how they're doing compared to their neighbors and a little positive reinforcement can go a long way and costs virtually nothing.
You've characterized your ideas in Nudge as being libertarian paternalism. Isn't that a contradiction in terms?
Well, it is a bit, but not the way we define it. So by paternalism, all we really mean is help people as judged by themselves. So we advocate picking default options properly and automatically enrolling people into savings plans, but people have the option of opting out. I think it is possible to devise a policy that is good for people as they define it and retains all of their freedom to choose. And that's what we mean by libertarian paternalism.
Jenny Russell, the nudge theory seems to go to the heart of what David Cameron is about. He disagrees with Margaret Thatcher, who famously did or didn't say there is no such thing as society. What he was saying is yes to the idea of society, it's just not the same thing as the state. In other words, we have a duty to tackle social breakdown, but it shouldn't always be the state that does it. It should be voluntary and charities at the grassroots level. Is that a new and interesting and helpful and modernised way of running the country, or is that about running down the state?
I don't think anyone's yet quite sure how that's going to work out. I mean, Labour people are very sceptical about this and say this is just an excuse to cut taxes and have a tiny state again. But it's very clear when you talk to the Tories that there is now, and this is a change from 20 years ago, a deep commitment to improving the lives of the poorest people in the country and having social justice and having greater social mobility. And they certainly, the people at the top, are very genuine about wanting to make those changes. I think what nobody really understands is whether it is possible to do things like that using voluntary groups in the third sector, or whether those are just groups that have to add something extra to what the state will provide as a matter of statutory provision and norms. Because nobody knows, and the voluntary sector themselves is certainly very uncertain about whether they could possibly bear the kind of weight of responsibility that the Conservatives might want to lay on them. On the other hand, all kinds of people look around and say, well, there's no doubt that, say, social workers have often been infinitely less effective at changing the lives of poor and deprived children than, say, original projects like Kids Company, run in South London by Camilla Batman-Gellidge. Now, the question is, can you actually roll that kind of individual project out all over the place, or do you have to say, we're just going to have some mavericks doing splendid things and we're going to have to stick to something rather more basic that's delivered through the state?
So, Michael Gove, Jenny Russell says that people aren't quite sure. Julian Glover says that there are differences and divisions between Labour and the Conservatives. Can you answer that fundamental question, doing things from the bottom up, is that a great and helpful and caring new vision, or is it about running down the state?
What a question.
And when did I stop beating my wife? I think the first thing to appreciate is that wrapped up in what we've been discussing are two principles which go together, but which it's important to disengage. The first is, when we're talking about things like social justice and the delivery of public services, do they all need to be delivered by the state from the centre? And the second question is, when it comes to encouraging the sort of behaviour that we consider to be responsible, ethical, moral, social, is it the case that we need legislation and direction from the centre, or can we look at a more subtle set of incentives in order to try to facilitate the sort of behaviour that makes our communities more cohesive and promotes well-being? So, for example, when it comes to thinking about education, our proposal is that we use the state strongly to shift resources towards the poorer, but we give poorer families, more disadvantaged families, the chance to choose between existing state provision and new providers who might provide them with the sort of education that they consider is closer to what they want and aspire to for their children. And then separately, when it comes to questions like relationships, one of the questions that the work of authors like those behind Nudge force us to consider is, how do we study the psychology of behaviour? What are the influences that we can work with in order to try to encourage people to do the right thing?
So, Julian Glover, Michael Gove said it's not the end of the state, it's just the end of the crude and heavy-handed state. But you were saying there are divisions, there are differences between Labour and the Conservatives. Can you just outline, obviously you're not a spokesman for the Labour Party, but outline what their critique is? What are they saying? Why are they worried that this is dangerous?
Well, I think they'd say that the Conservative Party may have shown, and voters can see it, the state hasn't always delivered the things it was supposed to do. What the Conservative Party can't show is that not having the state or doing it through community action will deliver those goals in a different way. The fear is that those goals will just be abandoned. And if the Conservative Party really does believe the state is failing, perhaps it should just leave society to see whether it generates through self-help some of the ambitions it wants. It can't really direct them. And that's where I worry about this Nudge thing that everybody's talking about suddenly, behavioural economics. Nudge really is just nanny in a different form. It's a nice word. It always shows if you want to be a guru, come up with a buzzword and it'll get columns in papers. It doesn't mean all that much, really. Who's doing the nudging and what direction is the nudging going? If it's still the state just trying to shove people and make them do stuff, then that really isn't a huge philosophical shift. The big brave change for the Tories, and the one Labour suspects, I'm not sure it's real, but the one Labour suspects, is the Tories just want to abandon it all to a free-for-all society, the kind of world before the NHS when community hospitals might be developed. You might get a very good charitable hospital in a town, or you might get no hospital.
Michael.
But, this is an interesting thing. In an earlier interview in The Guardian this week, Ed Miliband, I think, described David Cameron as a libertarian, and certainly that's the phrase that...
Yeah, they think that's a horrible word, isn't it?
That Gordon Brown uses about him. Yeah, and of course, it means many different things. You know, on one level, David Cameron is broadly libertarian. He's not judgmental about huge spheres of personal conduct. However, there's one area where he is not a libertarian, and that's the whole question of commitment, relationships, and the responsibilities that parents have towards their children. That came through in the interview that he gave to The Guardian this week when he talked about Barack Obama's speech. But it's also there in the vote that you referred to earlier, Nick, about fathers and IVF. Now, whatever view you take, what David Cameron believes is that we should use a variety of signals, some of them from the centre, others generated by society, which can be nudged, encouraged, buttressed and supported in order to try to make it easier for people when faced with the pulverising effects of, you know, economic change, to stay together, to celebrate their commitment and to keep their children in a secure environment. And there are specific interventions that we're talking about that are statist, for want of a better word, like making health visitor provision universal. And then there are other provisions which are much more sort of graded and nuanced. But the reason why we're talking about a range of interventions and policy prescriptions here is because David explicitly believes that we can't tackle poverty unless we provide an environment which encourages people to demonstrate that responsibility.
So, Jenny Russell, Michael Gove was talking there about the importance of encouraging responsibility, which takes us to Glasgow East, where David Cameron made a very significant speech last week on the broken society. He took a very important step forward when he said, it's time to distinguish between right and wrong. It's time to say tough messages like obese people, some obese people may be partly to blame for their condition. Did you see that as a significant step, or did you see it as a dangerous step? Remember, Macmillan famously said, leave morality to the bishops.
I thought it was an important and a brave thing to say, actually. I think when you look around at what's happened in Britain over the past 11 years, you couldn't say that simply standing back and saying people must be free to do exactly as they want and we mustn't make any judgments has led to a good society, and it's leading to a worse and worse one. I think there's no question that we do have to start taking responsibility, and it's incredibly dangerous territory for a politician to venture into. And I thought that Cameron did it sensitively. If you read the whole speech rather than the excerpts, which got rather misrepresented in some papers, he was saying that, of course, you have to take account of people's backgrounds and their situations and so on. But nevertheless, there are choices to be made. I was thinking of this when I sat on a train a couple of days ago, on a tube train in London. There was a woman sitting opposite with a small boy of about 8 next to her. They didn't speak a word, but she handed him a bar of chocolate, which was larger than his head, which he ate his way through. And when he finished, he handed it back to him, which was clearly a well-established ritual. She folded up the foil paper and the outside wrapping, and then she got out of the bag a bag of crisps, which was larger than the child's head, and handed it to him. And he ate his way solidly through all that too. And you sat there looking at him in absolute amazement, thinking, well, A, this child who's already fat is heading for a heart attack. Secondly, why isn't someone nudging this woman in the right direction? I mean, this is insanity. And I think the same thing applies to relationships. People behave according to the way that their friends and neighbours and peer group around them behave. And we're establishing norms in this society about parenting, for instance, in some communities where lots of people feel there's no point having fathers and nobody else has a father or a husband. Why would you bother to attach yourself to one? Why would they make the effort of staying with you? Now, I do think that is disastrous. We see how disastrous that is.
Now, and Julian, let me just ask you that David Cameron then went one step further this week when he criticised absentee black fathers and echoed Barack Obama's comments in the US, said that black fathers need to take part in a responsibility revolution. A wide welcome for those remarks. Could have been controversial one day.
It's remarkable, isn't it? Tory leader behind in the polls saying that, we would have really gone for him. Now, I think the Cameron speech was important and it was interesting, and it was certainly better than Labour says, and Labour tends to dismiss it as just telling fat people not to be fat. And that's a very simplistic reading of it. And the fact we've been talking about this speech for nearly 2 weeks, well, the government, what have the government been doing? Why are we talking about Cameron all the time? This is telling. This is showing Cameron is getting something through. But we must remember society isn't as broken as Cameron might like to say. We've got crime figures today that show crime, in overall crime, is going down. It's been going down since 1995. It began under the Tories. That might have lots of reasons. It might be the economy that's been driving it down. But society isn't falling to bits. And there's a danger for the Tories in talking too strongly about a universal breakdown in values, in parenting, in relationships, which just isn't happening. And contrasting that with a specific failure in certain areas. And Easterhouse in Glasgow, there are problems. The Tories are right to point those out, and they've done it well. It doesn't mean the whole of Britain is collapsing. Cameron doesn't want to look like he's a doom monger on that.
Michael Gove, isn't that a really important point from Julian Glover there?
Yes.
Which is that parts of society might be broken, but society as a whole, which is the Cameron message, society as a whole is not broken.
I think it's right to celebrate those areas where Britain's been successful, where we're richer, in some cases happier, genuinely freer than we were 20 or 30 years ago, a generation ago. However, we can't be indifferent to the fact that there is a significant section of British society that's being left behind in all sorts of ways. If you look at what's happening in our schools, those people who come from wealthier backgrounds are pulling ahead of those who come from poorer backgrounds, not just in terms of the exams they pass, but also in terms of the jobs they get, the wages they command, the lifestyle that they can enjoy subsequently. And it is also the case that within a significant number of people in Britain, their quality of life is severely impaired by not just a lack of cash, but also a lack of skills, a lack of strong relationships, a lack of all the things that contribute to happiness and well-being. So society is broken in the sense that if we take a one-nation view of what Britain should be, if we see a group of people pulling ahead, richer, wealthier, freer, and another group of people falling behind, their lives poorer in every sense, then that is a breakage, a fracture in society, in the heart of society. You know, that's one point that unites David Cameron and Polly Toynbee.
Final question for the three of you. Who's going to be Prime Minister in 2 years' time?
David Cameron.
Julian Glover.
Well, I'm tempted to say Michael Gove, but I suppose that will be 5 years, so maybe David Cameron in a short-lived administration.
Prime Minister Gove, who's going to be Prime Minister in 2 years' time?
Well, two things. One, I hope and pray it's David Cameron, but you never know. As Gordon Brown would say, that's a matter for the British people, and you know, we'll see. Second thing, though, I can give the Guardian podcast an exclusive. Under no circumstances would I ever, 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 ever want to be Prime Minister. One of the things I've learned watching David Cameron do the job.
Notice you say what, not will.
No, never. I mean, I can't think of the superlatives or the underlinings that I can do to make it clear enough. But one thing I have learned watching David Cameron over the course of the last 3 years is that in order to lead, you need something special. He has it, I don't.
Well, on that note, thank you all very much. That's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the Shadow School Secretary Michael Gove, the Guardian columnist Jenny Russell, and the Guardian's chief leader writer Julian Glover. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week for the results of the Glasgow East by-election and the Politics Weekly end-of-term assessment of Gordon Brown. Till then, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.